Xi Jinping has become China's most powerful communist leader since Mao Zedong. He secured a third term as party chief and promoted loyalists to his inner circle. So how will they steer China into the future? This is Inside Story. Hello there and welcome to the program. I'm Nick Clark. Xi Jinping is now the most powerful leader since Mao Zedong founded the People's Republic of China in 1949. He secured an unprecedented third term as Communist Party leader. It came at the end of a week-long congress, a highly choreographed event held every 5 years to choose new leaders and to approve policy. Xi further cemented his power by appointing six close allies to the Politburo Standing Committee, the government's senior leadership team. All of them have been loyal to Xi throughout his political career, and they include Li Qiang, who's likely to become the next premier. The Shanghai party chief enforced China's strict zero COVID policy by locking down the wealthiest and most populous city for 2 months earlier this year. Xi promised the team will achieve what he calls the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation.
Just as China can't develop in isolation from the world, it needs China for its development. Through over 40 years of relentless reform and opening up, we have created the twin miracles of fast economic growth and social stability. China will open its doors ever wider. We will be steadfast in deepening reform and opening up across the board. A prosperous China will create many more opportunities for the world.
Well, Xi Jinping's appointment means his vision for China is here to stay, at least for another 5 years. His zero COVID policy has been blamed for hurting the second biggest economy in the world. Analysts believe China will fail to meet its goal of 5.5% GDP growth this year. Xi says his government has lifted nearly 100 million people out of extreme poverty since he came to power in 2012. But huge challenges remain. China has become more assertive on the global stage. It's pushed back against Western sanctions for allegations of rights abuses in Xinjiang and in Hong Kong. And Beijing has become more vocal about unification with the self-ruled island of Taiwan. Well, we'll bring in our guests in just a moment. But first, let's get the very latest from Patrick Fok.
Well, it goes without saying that the new leadership is going to be faced with some pretty serious challenges, not least some severe economic headwinds. And there has been a lot of talk about the shake-up to China's economic leadership, which includes not just the departure of Premier Li Keqiang, but also the economy czar, Liu He, the central bank chief, Yi Gang, as well as banking regulator, Guo Shuqing. All are seen as pro-market reformists. And it's not apparent, as it stands, how the new faces poised to take over the running of the world's second largest economy will perform. But there is a general consensus that there is a lot less experience among them, and also a view that they are likely to carry out President Xi Jinping's vision for a more state-driven market approach. President Xi has also linked this idea of the Chinese dream to the concept of common prosperity and widening the distribution of wealth among the Chinese people. That's certainly something that chimes with the public, but in practice, the crackdown on the tech and property sectors in particular have been incredibly destabilizing over the last couple of years. It's difficult to say how this might have played out outside of the zero COVID policy, but again, looking at this leadership lineup, there doesn't seem to be any intention to move away from this zero COVID policy anytime soon either.
All right, so now let's bring in our panel. In Beijing, we have Aylin Tangid, who's senior fellow at the Tahoe Institute think tank. In London, Marco Vincenzino, a geopolitical risk analysis. And in Hamburg, Stefan Ost, editor-at-large for the German Welt N24 publishing group and co-author of Xi Jinping, the most powerful man in the world. A warm welcome, gentlemen, to you all. And Stefan Ost in Hamburg, if I could start with you, first of all. To learn and get an idea about the future, we have to look to the past. How does President Xi's approach compare to that of his predecessors after Mao Zedong?
Well, he's going back into Chinese history, if you want to put it that way. in two different ways. First one, he wants to be the leader after Mao Zedong. And at the same time, he's rather close to the Chinese tradition. So when, for instance, Confucius, you know, was not very well accepted in the Mao Zedong times, he takes that into his view. He has changed the way since Deng Xiaoping, who opened the country to the world market. He was helped by Richard Nixon and Kissinger. They were there, and so they opened the country. And I think most of the biggest reasons for the economic growth of that huge country is the opening of the borders and taking part in the world market. But the interesting thing is, it was a divided country all the time, divided into two. One, you have a communist party in power, and on the other hand, you have a more or less capitalist economic system. And he is on the way to bring it back into socialism. So he is not closing the borders, but he's more concentrating on the interior market of China, and so that makes the government more authoritarian than it had been before.
All right, let's get the view from Beijing, Aina Tangen. Is that something that you agree with? Why does President Xi want a third term? Is it because he doesn't trust anybody else to carry out his vision?
Well, when he took over, there were severe problems. Corruption was one of them. And they needed to... there was a issue. Mao united the people with the ideology. You know, it was always about socialist workers, paradise, all these types of things. Deng brought about a new kind of practicism on there. I mean, it's very just, you know, white cat, black cat, doesn't matter as long as they catch mice. The difficulty is you have to, she sees that there are advantages in both. In order for China to go forward, it not only has to retain the trust of its people, but it has to deliver. It's a socialist society. They've never abandoned that. I don't know where I get this idea that they have. But, you know, it was very clear. They want to have people-centered policies which use economics, the market, to get where they think they need to be. They want it to be sustainable. They want it to be regional and worldwide if they can. But they're battling a lot of headwinds. And right now, what he's trying to do is assemble a team that can work very swiftly along the lines that he thinks are necessary. He thought that three terms would be there, but I can almost guarantee you that he will not pass on all the powers he's amassed to the next generation. He'll probably, split them up just as Deng Xiaoping did when he did it. Remember, he was in many ways much more powerful because he was able to choose not only his successor, Jiang Zemin, but also Hu Jintao, which he said, yes, after Zhang, who will be the guy. Very impressive, given that he passed away prior to that time. So this is the kind of long-term thinking that they want to engage in. They have goals that go beyond 2049, and they're going to need a new generation of leadership to do that. And today you saw him moving four people from the 60s onto the standing committee. These are people who can eventually take over the reins.
All right. Marco, what do you make of that and the concept that China has never abandoned the idea of socialism?
Basically, this Congress has obviously consolidated Xi's centrality at home and abroad. And whatever they can use of the free market system to further centralize power. The key word, I think, here is centralization. Centralization of power, economic, political, security, across the board. And he succeeded at that at the beginning of this third term. And it's not just about be at home. His centrality in terms of his his key role abroad. Remember, within a 40-year period, China has gone to become basically the second-largest economy in the world. It is the assembly line of the world. There's no doubt about that. And as he expands his power at home and expands Chinese influence overseas, he wants to create a more multipolar world with China at its center. And he's well on his way to doing so, I mean, definitely in the region, but even in different parts of the world. I mean, you look at parts of Latin America, Africa, where China has become the leading trading partner to many of these countries. So this is what we see is not just symbolic, but it's actually even beyond symbolic. It's actually real. It's achieving concrete results. And he sees that by eliminating any form of opposition at home, he's been able to project that leverage and that power abroad. And he uses that leverage abroad with other countries, particularly economically weaker countries, to make sure that China's interests and China's agenda is extended throughout different parts of the world.
I know you were talking about the Politburo lineup, you know, all protégés and loyalists, right? Is there anyone there with a different view? And if not, is that healthy?
Well, generally, I would say no. I mean, the system before generally had different interests, different perspectives from market side, from ideological side. But that's not true right now. And the reason is, and you know, previous speaker was talking about, you know, China doing this and that. You know, I think he was talking about the United States in terms of leverage and pushing different countries to do this, that, or the other thing, or choose between us and them. You know, China isn't there. China is not trying to create a new center of a multipolar world. They're simply reacting to the kind of constant pressure that's coming from the United States as it seeks to maintain its hegemony. You know, in terms of this new standing things, yes, they all are people who work with him. If China was a corporation, people would say, yes, he's taking control. He's taking the reins. He's putting his team in. Now, remember, whatever happens from here on out is going to be on Xi Jinping. You know, they always say the winner wants the ball. Well, right now, Xi Jinping has the ball, and he's under a tremendous amount of pressure that he's created for himself to deliver. So this idea that, you know, he's just going to sit back and have a golden palace idea, he doesn't live that way, and he's not interested in it. He wants to move China ahead. You know, I think everyone here could agree on that. You just might not agree on the way that he does it. But results will speak for themselves.
Okay, Stefanos, so Xi Jinping has the ball, and the way he's created this situation is he's reacting to pressure from the United States.
Well, in a certain way, it's true. If you look back on the fall of the wall, the end of the split of the world into the capitalist and the socialist part, when you still have the Soviet Union, afterwards, it was always said that the United States are the only surviving superpower in the world. But that definitely has changed since China is getting so important, maybe overtaking from the national product the United States, while actually having four times as many people in the country is normal that you have a bigger economic development. But nevertheless, I think he changes the path of the Chinese politics a little bit, going back into the own country, and he is obviously on the way to shut down the borders at least partly. And as far as I know, there are a lot of companies in different continents of the world who think about, shall we go again to China and invest there when we have to go into a quarantine for the first week and the conditions are not that good for the people from other countries, then we can go as well to Vietnam
because of his COVID policy, right?
Oh yes, definitely. I think and I'm very skeptical whether that really functions. I don't really think that you can stop a virus. That's not possible. And I think he uses this to make his power even more concrete than it was before. It's a lot of explanation that they have to do it because of COVID. But he just that helps a dictatorial system maintain their power over other people. And the question is whether this will be good for the development of the economics and the development of the country itself.
All right, Stefan, we'll leave. I'm just going to jump in there. Marco, I'm going to come to you in a second. But first, I just want to go back to Aina because I can see that you're shaking your head at what Stefan's been saying.
I don't understand. I mean, are you denying that vaccines are, you know, or that we have COVID or that precautions are necessary? I mean, I thought we were over that with the, you know, this kind of Trump-esque idea that there's nothing you can do and therefore you can make a health decision into politics. Perhaps you're advocating we eject bleach or something. Come on, this is supposed to be a serious discussion.
Stefan, let Stefan respond to that, Aina, first of all. Stefan, come back to you.
No, actually, I'm not doubting that there is corona, the pandemic, but you can see in the European countries and in America as well that the lockdown policy didn't work for a long run.
Okay. Let's not get into the weeds of lockdown policies. I want to get on to the statement we just played a clip of a little bit earlier. President Xi saying that China will open its doors even wider, ever wider, and be steadfast in deepening reform. Let's look at those two things. Marco, first of all, this concept of openness, this is disingenuous, isn't it? When China, hasn't it become more closed off under Xi Jinping?
Listen, I mean, an argument can be made that zero COVID policy, part of it, was used as a pretext to further centralize power. I don't think there's any secret in that. But what happens is that sends a signal to the rest of the world also. If you just look at it economically, this was a massive disruption in global supply chains. So nations around the world, particularly major powers, whether it's the U.S., Europe, other countries, there needs to be a serious rethink about the reconfiguration of global supply chains. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, this delinking, this talk of delinking in China is going to completely happen. There's a tendency towards it. You need to diversify. But I think China will still have a major role in terms of being a global supply chain, as part of the global supply chain. But it needs to be diversified because in case of future crisis, it's only pragmatic, it's only convenient to have alternative sources. The problem is that many other countries around the world, many companies and many businesses around the world for far too long concentrated that supply line within China itself. And when you have crises, it shows you need reliable alternatives. Other sources, mentions that have been made of Vietnam, India. Can these places supply all of what China's been able to supply? Probably not. But you still have to diversify, and that's a key thing. People talk about reshoring, bringing back closer to home. But in reality, is you can only do so much of that. We live in a world that's deglobalization is a term that we hear a lot about. But I think there's going to be an approach where you start to bring in the supply chains a bit more home. But it's not a black or white. It's more of a complex gray zone.
All right. Aina Tangen, he also mentioned in his speech that we will be steadfast in deepening reform, he said. What reforms does he mean? Because he doesn't mean human rights reform, does he? Or media freedom?
Well, it's a loaded question. I mean, China's narrative on human rights is more about economic opportunity, safety in the streets, access to social services. In the West, we always look at it as a ballot box and the ability to say whatever you want whenever you feel like it. But, you know, as China goes forward, yes, there it has to be more reforms. I mean, there's a lot of red tape. They have to deal with the fact that they lost a lot of their small and medium-sized enterprises. It's laughable, this idea that China is concerned about its health concern and that this is all part of some vast conspiracy to destabilize the world. China only does well when the world is doing well. So at this juncture, they need to take care of their internal situation. COVID has cost them a tremendous amount, but they did it because they were interested in, you know, the health of people. Also, the number of people who are going to die. They could have easily opened up and just said, look, you know, we're a big country. We can afford to have a bunch of people go. That was a decision that was made in Europe. It was a decision that was made in the United States. And it was flawed. It resulted in many more deaths than were necessary. It resulted in a world that was not vaccinated, that, you know, you can find billions of dollars to pour into Ukraine over 7 months, but you couldn't find $50 billion to inoculate the world and lessen the severity of this particular outbreak. Right now, 17 million people have long COVID in Europe alone. 500,000 people are attributed to have left the workforce in the U.S.
I know. I'm going to move it on. We have 5 minutes of the show left. We've still got quite a lot to cover, which we're not going to get through. But if I can come back to Stefan, the global implications of this, let's explore that a little bit further. What about Taiwan? Will China's assertive approach turn into actual physical aggression? Is that how all this is? Is that the direction it's moving now?
Well, actually, in the years before, it was like in Germany. You know, all politicians talked on Sunday about reunification, and it was a little bit like that in China. But he says now that Taiwan has to come back to China during his time, as long he is in power. So we can be happy that he prolonged his term and doesn't have to do it tomorrow. But I think if they really take military invasion or something, we will have the biggest economic crisis in the world that we ever had. And even now, when you compare it to what the sanctions the West makes against Russia because of the invasion into the Ukraine, this idea is always in the mind of politicians and the public when there is a new plan for China, for instance, to buy parts of institutions at the Hamburg harbor. There are good reasons for them to try that, and there are good reasons for the harbor to talk about this, because we have a lot of ships. Most of the ships, that container ships that come to Hamburg, are from China, and they could easily go to Antwerpen or wherever. So we always think, what will happen if they would really invade Taiwan, and we would have sanctions then against China and against Chinese companies, for instance, in Germany. So the talk of invading or military operations against Taiwan stop a lot of people and or other countries to cooperate and work together with China.
Okay. Marco, is Xi Jinping invincible now, do you think? Is there enough dissent within anywhere within the ranks for him to face any pressure?
I think at this stage, after 10 years, and it's been a process of gradual centralization and consolidation, I think at this stage, particularly with the new members of the Politburo, he's basically solidified all the main instruments of power, both political, diplomatic, military. So I think for the next 5 years, definitely. I mean, pretty much he does not have any opposition or serious opposition or people within the party who can challenge him at this stage. And I agree. I mean, this is the third, but don't underestimate his ability to bring on potentially even a fourth term. So I think as long as he's alive, he'll be in power, as long as he wants to stay in power.
And Ina, we're talking about the politics here and power politics at the top. What does all this mean for the ordinary Chinese person, from the city dweller to somebody who's living far out in rural China? What impact on their lives has President Xi had and will have by the policies that he's implementing? We've literally got a minute and a half to go.
Okay. So I've been able to travel during this COVID period and go out to these remote areas and talk to these people. First off, they like Xi Jinping. 90% of them do. I would suspect that there'd be slightly less because there's still frustration over over the pandemic. But in the end, how have they been affected? Extreme poverty is down. If you go to the countryside, they love Xi Jinping. They think that he has done a great job for them. It's in the cities that you run into people who say much larger expectations. And they say, oh, gee, you know, I'm losing money in the stock market, or you know, the house I wanted to buy, couldn't buy it, or, you know, the mortgage is too high and things like that. So you have different sets of expectations. China's a huge country, and people are trying to react it in different ways. But, you know, Xi Jinping has, as I said, he's put the ball in his own hands. The check on his power is going to be his ability to deliver, and that cannot be disguised. He either does it or he doesn't.
Gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there. We'll be closely watching what happens over the next 5 years. But thank you very much, Ina Tang and Marco Vincenzino and Stefan Ost. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. We are at AJInsideStory. From me, Nick Clark, and the entire team here, it's goodbye for now.